friends, you're listening to Irish Radio Network USA. I have a couple of guests in the studio, one I've known indeed for, I thought it was more than 17 years, but Kevin Cullen, who is a reporter and has been for the last 17 years.
Much
with
more than that.
Yeah.
That's a little bio.
That's,
I'm an old man age.
That's what I figured.
Yeah, I've been there 20
years. That's what I love. First of all, I love years. When I get a bio after I sit down with my guest. And more often than not, it's something that has taken off Wikipedia or one of the, you know, where it is. But no, because I was going to say one of us is older than we think we are. And but you're looking good, let me tell you.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right. And the book. The book, finally, we have a book. I it seems like forever that we have spoken, not so much on air, but on any occasion where we have met and where we're in company, half tongue in cheek. People say, what's the story with Whitey Bulger? Because it seems... It has seemed that you have been the authority on, and many would say that Kevin Cullen is, yeah, I don't know what he has up his sleeve, but there's something that the Cullen is not telling us. And then, of course,
I saved
many
it for the book.
Huh?
I
yeah.
saved it for the
well,
book.
You saved
the
it
real
for the
authority
book.
On Whitey Bulger is sitting right next to me. That's really? Shelley Murphy.
Well, could you?
The Savin Hill Murphys via Cork.
Oh, my. Cork. Yeah, and if your bio is okay, Cork and Kerry, I mean, that's a double whammy right there.
It's a mixed marriage. The kingdom and the rebels.
Shelley, you're very welcome.
Thank you. Very nice to be here.
What's your story?
My story, I...
With Bulger.
Well, I've been writing about him since the 80s.
Wow.
So, and actually have, you know, from the early days when he was still running the rackets in Boston, right up to his capture, and fielded quite a few tips that he was in Ireland. I know people were convinced that he had been spotted
absolutely.
In Galway
yeah.
wearing a dress.
And by the way, since we are broadcasting worldwide, let's give you an idea of this. Actually, his name is James Bulger, known as Whitey Bulger, America's most wanted gangster and the most elusive. He was on top of the list, the FBI most wanted list, which is somewhat ironic considering that, among other things, which you learn from the book, is that he had quite a comfortable arrangement. with the FBI as an informer or whatever. But Whitey Bulger, to be on the run, to be on Interpol, to be on a list for, what was it?
16 years.
16 years is almost an incredible story in itself, considering that, putting it mildly, he's not a very nice guy. As a matter of fact, he's a ruthless murderer.
Right. He's charged with 19 murders, including two women.
Well, you can't find somebody if you're not looking for him. And as you'll see in the book,
okay.
They weren't looking for him the first 2 years.
Talk about Boston. Talk about the Southeast.
You know, Shelley and I, when we sat down to do this, it's a multi-layered story. I mean, it's obviously a crime story. It's also a political story. It's a there's a love story wrapped in there with among all the bodies. And at the end of the day, it's an Irish story because a lot of this it plays out against this landscape of South Boston is literally a peninsula, and it's figuratively in Ireland. An island. And it was obviously predominantly Irish, but it was also had a lot of different ethnic groups, Lithuanians, Poles, Italians, but the ethos of Southie is Irish. The the unofficial mascot of South Boston is the leprechaun there with his dukes up, ready to have it out, the sort of belligerent leprechaun. And the ethos in the town...
A tough...
When he grew up there, it was a rough, hard scrabble place. The only reason they ended up in South Boston is actually because FDR built a housing project there as part of the New Deal, and they moved there. But Whitey grew up in this place where you had to be tough. And the other thing he grew up... I think one of the sense of Irishness there about Southie is that loyalty was something that was really emphasized, perhaps overemphasized. Loyalty to your family, loyalty to your neighbors, loyalty to your neighborhood. And you know, take out of that too, the worst thing you could be in Southie was a rat, an informer. And Whitey would have grown up knowing that too. And that's part of this Irish story, which is why, as we detail in the book, when he made his deal with the local, you know, his old friend from the neighborhood, John Conley, the FBI agent, he was so insistent that he would be not known as an informer.
Right.
He hated that word. So he said that, you know, call me an analyst, call me a strategist, call me a consultant, but don't call me an informer.
Right. Somewhat akin in terms of historically, somewhat like Hell's Kitchen.
Very comparable, actually.
Yeah.
In fact, Whitey had some friends from Hell's Kitchen when he was convicted of bank robbery in the mid-50s.
Yeah.
He served time in Atlanta and Alcatraz and became friendly with some of the Westies.
Okay.
And Tommy DeVaney, was it?
Yeah,
he was
Tommy DeVaney.
Now, who were the Bulgers, the Bulger family?
Well, they're a big clan that came, like I said, they moved to South Boston specifically to live in that housing project that was built and opened in 1938. But, you know, a big family. And one of the things we explain in the book, back in that era, it was not unusual that out of the same household, one person would go one way. I mean, Whitey in the story of his brother Billy Bulger, who became one of the most powerful politicians in Massachusetts. It's an updated version of Angels with Dirty Faces and Jimmy Cagney and Pat O'Brien.
Wow.
And Whitey went one way, and Billy went another. But one of the things we show in the book is how they had a symbiotic relationship, and that Whitey learned, basically through his brother's success, that to be a gangster and to be a successful gangster, you need to be politically connected too. And as a result, you know, Billy's strength in politics helped Whitey get out of prison. He got a 20-year bid for bank robbery, and he got out after 9 years. And as Shelley and I found out, his parole advisor and one of his, you know, his pen pals in prison was the future congressman, Robert Drinan, Father Robert Drinan, who was then, you know, at the time was the dean of Boston College Law School. And then as Shelley did some incredible work finding his prison records, and what it showed is that the Speaker of the House, John McCormick, who was also from the neighborhood and a family friend, intervened very often on Whitey's behalf while he was in prison, and was able to effect that the head of the U.S. Bureau of Prisons actually visited Whitey on Alcatraz when he was doing time there, because the House Speaker, John McCormick, intervened. So like I said, the politics is essential to the story. It's not just, you know, in Boston, Adrian, the only thing we care about is politics, sports, and revenge. We are an Irish town.
Not necessarily in that order. Listen, I don't want to talk out of turn. You're a guest in New York. So, Shelley, how did he get to be from a not even a good petty thief to, in very short order, becoming a bank robber? I mean, it wasn't from experience. He didn't have enough time to work his way up to that. That's a pretty big jump.
Right. Well, he was actually fortunate. You know, in life, timing is often everything. And when he was in prison for bank robbery, there were gang wars in Boston, the Irish gang wars. More than 60 people were killed. And had he been on the street during those gang wars, he probably would have been caught up in that. So when he came out, he was able to sort of very quickly, you know, move up.
Yeah.
You know, joining as an enforcer for a gang. So he had some help too along the way.
Yeah.
Timing, as Shelley says, timing is everything, because when he came out and hooked up with the Killeens, they were the premier criminal gang in South Boston. They really controlled a lot of the rackets. And back then, before the state lottery existed, the bookmakers were making a ton of money. There was a bookie in every bar in Southie. And they were, you know, Whitey was making money. But then there was another internecine gang war among the Irish in Southie. And that pitted the Killeen gang against the Mullins, these an upstart group of Irish Americans, which included Pat Nee, who's Galway-born and a real tough guy in his own right. And when that war, after a number of killings, Whitey was able to go to the head of the Winter Hill gang, a guy named Howie Winter, and they were the dominant Irish gang in the Boston area. And Whitey basically prevailed upon Whitey prevailed upon Howie to settle the gang war. And as and Howie was so impressed with Whitey, because Whitey has a lot of charisma, he comes off as a tough guy, and frankly, Howie was very impressed that Whitey had done time in Alcatraz. Howie handpicked Whitey as the leader of the Irish gang in Southie, and more specifically, made him a full-fledged member of the Winter Hill gang.
Yeah.
Because so Whitey really started making money then.
The Irish mafia, were they mafia wannabes? Where did they race in terms of...
It's interesting because the Irish gang always had Italians in them. Some of the most lethal guys that work for what we call the Irish gangs in Boston were actually Italian guys. And obviously, Whitey's partner in crime, Steve Fleming, came from an Italian background. His parents were Italian immigrants. But I think, you know, it's interesting when you look at Fleming, because Fleming's a big part of this book, too. If you look at Fleming, Fleming was the real guy that the FBI needed. Because Whitey, you know, John Connally made a deal with Whitey, as much to protect the Bulger family, and because John sort of believed in this whole idea that Whitey was a benevolent good gangster, that he was a good bad guy, as they would call it. But the FBI really did need information on the mafia because they were launching. So Steve Fleming came as a package deal. The FBI actually put these guys together and made them informants and made them a team. And it was useful for, like I said, it was careerism for Connally at one level. It was protecting the Bulgers at another level. And yet, he actually did get a pretty good informant when he got Fleming, because Fleming knew the Italians. Fleming could give him the mafia guys. Whitey didn't know much about the mafia guys, and they certainly wouldn't confide in them.
But what's sort of the timing here is that, you know, the FBI had a national mandate to target the mafia, and they did not take into account regional differences. So in Boston, the Irish gangs were equally powerful, and yet the FBI was targeting only La Cosa Nostra, not the Irish gangs, and made this deal with Whitey to be an informant to provide information on his rivals in the mafia, and it really allowed him to rise as the mafia leaders in Boston, wave after wave, was prosecuted and carted off to prison. Whitey sort of swooped in and became even more powerful than he had been.
We have a great scene in the book, Adrian, in which, and this is a real Irish thing, Whitey's in the car with John Connally, and Connally's asking him to become an informant. And Whitey said two things. He said, "I won't give up my friends, and I won't give up the IRA." And it was like, who said anything about the IRA? Yeah. But Whitey had always been sort of a barstool patriot in the sense that he was very involved, very supportive of the provost in the early 70s when things were really hot.
Yeah.
But once he got the protection of the FBI, when he became an informant, Shelley and I found that his involvement with the IRA skyrocketed. It really went forward. And you had the situation in which Joe Cahill, the founder of the Provisional IRA, was actually secreted into the country. They couldn't come into America, so they flew him into Canada. And what they did is the Irish gang guys got a busload of Boston Bruins fans and sent them up to the see a Canadiens game in Montreal. And three or four of the guys would then be, you know, it wasn't too hard to convince them they could stay drinking and watch you off for a week. And Joe Cahill and three other provosts would get on the bus, and they brought them down. And so you had the founder of the Provisional IRA meeting with Whitey Bulger in a bar in South Boston. And basically, the Irish gang in Boston were commissioned to become weapons procurers for the IRA. It's extraordinary.
Shelley, with all due respect, how'd you hook up with this guy?
We go way back.
Kevin or Whitey?
Kevin. No, well, Whitey was missing, so, I mean,
Kevin was
he was all over the place. It would appear that even though he is a very recognized darling of the Boston Globe as a ratter, not a ratter informer, but as somebody who can seek out crime and criminal activity and actually get up every morning loving every bit of it. But he was shoved over to, first of all, you did a stint in Trinity. Mm-hmm. And then the Globe set you up where you couldn't do any more harm over here.
Put me in Ireland.
Put you in Ireland.
Well, they used to tell the loyalists they were so dumb they didn't know the difference. They'd say, where do you live? I said, I live in Kingstown. Because I lived in Dunleary at the time. But Shelley and I actually met at the Boston Herald. We both were, like, among the young kids when Murdoch bought the paper. That was 83, Shell.
Yeah.
I think we got hired. So we go way back.
Yeah.
In fact, what year was that that I was at the Boston Herald and you were at the Globe?
It was
and
88.
Ray Flynn made his...
the two of us.
Ray Flynn made his trip to Ireland, which culminated with the BC Army game in Dublin.
I turned Murphy out to Guinness and salmon on open brown bread. Oh baby.
Boy. Want to ask you, I want to come back to you, Kevin, just for a moment, because there has been many references, and in fact it is, you learn from the book too, about an area that you're very familiar with, because you covered for more than 15 years the conflict in Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
And was the connection with the Southeast, with Boston, did that play much of a role?
Well, I mean, you know, the Irish
gang, did anybody care?
The Irish mob in Boston was behind the biggest importation of weapons to Ireland in history, in the history of that conflict, the more modern conflict. You know, it was a ship called Valhalla, which was out of the Boston area, and was loaded down with, you know, $1 million worth of weapons. And it was actually a shopping list. The provost wanted specific things. And so the Irish, as Pat Nee, who cooperated with Shelley and I for the book, he explained that, you know, they were going around town and getting donations for weapons from wise guys all over the place. They wanted their guns to go to the IRA. And these guys, you know, put together a very sophisticated
mission. Was it a commercial venture?
No. They didn't make money off it. They would have considered this something they did for principle. They really? They supported the provost, there's no doubt. I mean, Pat Nee was the real deal. He had a long relationship with the IRA and is quite proud of it, actually. Mm. Whitey, not so much, but Whitey was the big cheese in Southie, so he had to sign off on all of this stuff, too. But, you know, this was hatched at a very senior level in Ireland. And they dispatched a young American-born IRA man, which is pretty unusual, a guy named Crawley.
Uh-huh.
And he's an American citizen, and he was also trained in special forces for the Marines, the U.S. Marines. And then he joined the IRA in the mid-70s, I believe, or late 70s. And he was sent over to coordinate this mission and lived in Boston for quite a while. Uh-huh. I remember back in the 80s, there were a number of guys that were on the run. There were guys from the north who were on the run, and they were either working for the provost or they were just hiding out.
Right.
They're just hanging out.
You know, when you're talking about shipment and guns and weapons going from this country to Northern Ireland, there was corruption within. Again, FBI, CIA, just about anybody and everybody had, you know, their hands sullied somewhere along the way there, as in fact we saw in many of the trials that will come up afterwards, is that there was always somewhat of a connection with the FBI in particular. How did the FBI get away with that? I mean, how did they get to the point? Let me ask you, Shelley, have crime. You have murders. This is not like petty crime. This is
serious stuff.
This is terribly serious stuff. Murders smack under their noses, which they had to be aware of. and that's at best. How does, you know, the chief law enforcement agency in the United States, how did they manage to not swoop in, not, was the informant that important, that significant? And when did that, God forbid, when did that stop? When did, you know, when can we say, all right, maybe with the exposure of the Bulger and numerous other areas that was exposed. But how can we?
Well, when you go to the back to the beginning, you know, when John Conley recruited Whitey as an informant, he, you know, in the beginning it may have been a good deal, but as Whitey rose up and became more powerful, it became a very bad deal. And at some point he began, there was, as you said, widespread corruption. It started with cultivating relationships within the FBI. They had these cozy dinners and swapping Christmas gifts, and then it was giving payoffs, and then it was FBI agents sort of, you know, leaking information, and somebody would go to the FBI to cooperate with information about Whitey, and someone would leak word to Whitey, and they would be killed. And so it really, over the years, developed into this. And meanwhile, you have John Connolly telling people that Whitey's really not such a bad guy, and, you know, he's fighting the fight with us against the mafia. And Whitey was cultivating this relationship in the community as sort of a Robin Hood figure, which he wasn't. I mean, there was a myth that he kept the drugs out of the town, when in fact we know he actually was getting a cut of, you know, anybody who sold drugs in the area had to pay tribute to him.
What made him the most notorious cold-blooded killer, particularly when you look at the Irish mafia? I mean, Whitey comes to the top of every list.
I think if you read the book, what comes through, I think, is how charismatic this guy is. He's not your average criminal. I mean, when some of the records Shelley found out in his prison file is that he had a IQ of 118, mm-hmm. which would have made him that would be like what a university graduate would have. Mm-hmm. This is a guy that dropped out of school in ninth grade. He was a smart guy. And when he was in prison, he really used his time in prison. We call that chapter the University of Alcatraz. He did a lot of reading, and he did a lot of specific reading. He read a lot of Machiavelli. He read a lot of modern warfare history. He understood counterinsurgent methods. He really understood, and he used all that.
Was he connected, though, with the outside during that period?
When he was in prison?
Yeah.
Well, one of the things we go to great length in the book is to show that his brother Billy was really working on his behalf and was trying to help him, trying to get him out of prison early. And so that was, I think that's where the loyalty of the two brothers really intensified, because there's no doubt if Billy wasn't out there working for him, he never got out of prison.
Now, this is a guy that comes from basically an Irish Catholic family, and we have to assume that within the circle of the Bulger family, there would have been a great number of people who would have at least been aware that here was a criminal, a thug, somebody who, it just didn't surface after he was on the run that he had all of these murders. I mean, it was
a lot of denial in that family, I think. First of all, they really did believe. I think Billy, and some of the letters that Shelley obtained out there, Billy wrote to Whitey, or wrote on behalf of him while he was in prison, he really believed, I think, that Whitey was going to go straight when he got out. But as our research showed, Whitey dove right back into it. He might have worked in what we would call legitimate work for maybe a year or so, and at some time he concluded, I'm going back to the gang love. Yeah. And I think one of the things that I was struck by is his family never pushed him away. They never, I think there was an enabling sort of relationship going on with the wider family. I also think the Bulgers, in general, have a huge persecution complex. So Billy, in particular, would see the charges against his brother as just part more of the persecution of the Bulger family, and particularly aimed at him. And that's how Whitey has tried to portray some of the stuff. Like in 1988, I was part of the Globe Spotlight team, the investigative unit, that actually identified him as an FBI informant. And when Bulger met with the FBI after that, because they basically said, well, you've been outed as an informant. What about, are you worried? And he said, no one will believe it. They'll think the Globe just did this to get at my brother. That was the kind of thing that were going on in the city that Whitey really exploited, and to some extent, like I said, his family exploited it, because if they had pushed him away, if they basically said, if you want to stay involved in crime, you have no... Being involved in crime really, really put his brother in a tough spot. But I think there was an enormous amount of deference. Like I said, we did that story in 1988, but for years, people in Boston knew that the brother who was in charge of the State House was related to the brother who was in charge of the underworld. It's an extraordinary story.
Was there... did he live high?
No, I think he was very careful. He grew up poor. You know, his father had lost an arm in a rail accident, and he hated being without money. And so he made millions of dollars over the years, but he really didn't flaunt it. He had a condo down in Florida. He liked to go to Florida. At one point, he bought a Jaguar, and then he decided that it was too ostentatious, so he sold it. Was there
any evidence within his family that, you know, that they were...
No, I don't think we have. I mean, Billy was doing okay on himself. Billy is retired with a $200,000 pension now, because he was also the president of the University of Massachusetts until my friend over here got some interesting information about him, and he had to leave.
Okay, now, Shelley... investigating and we're talking about the most notorious top of the list FBI wanted murderer criminal. Did anybody ever take you aside and say, listen, you know, that's all right. Cullen is over there doing his thing. Maybe you ought to pull back a bit too, because you know, you're very prominent, and you didn't take a break from any of this. It seemed like, you know, that became something that your level of interest just honed on. I mean, that you've really made this a number one priority for yourself at a time when it would appear that maybe, like everybody else, you should have given up. Maybe Whitey Bulger was dead and gone. Maybe he, you know, if you have for self-preservation, but if the FBI can find a Whitey Bulger, every aspect of his life, you're scraping and uncovering, and it seems like you've made this a lifetime passion.
Well, I think it's such a fascinating story, and I think the one thing that Kevin and I never lost sight of is that we didn't romanticize him, that there were real victims in this case. I mean, there are families of 19 people who he's accused of murdering. And, you know, I was there when they were, you know, digging up secret graves around Boston with the remains of these people and watching family members stand vigil. So to me, the biggest tragedy would have been if he would have ride off into the sunset and nobody ever knew what happened to him. It was so important to see him captured and now, of course, to see him stand trial in June. We all want to hear, because there was so much corruption overshadowing this case, we want to hear what he has to say. You know, whether people believe it or not will be another question, but I think it's important to hear what he can tell us.
Let me ask you, first of all, Kevin, Pulitzer Prize winning journalist, and indeed very much associated with the Boston Globe. You've been, again, going back to 1985. Many awards for a lot of your writings, for a lot of your work. Did you believe that the time had come and gone with the Whitey story, and that the total unlikelihood that anything would ever that he would be discovered alive anywhere, that was getting...
I was very cynical. I thought he was not going to be found because the FBI didn't want to find him. But I think when they did find him, Shelley and I very quickly resolved to do this book, because there have been a lot of Whitey Bulger books, maybe too many.
Mm.
But if you look over the last 25 years, most of the stories that have broken information about Whitey were done by me in the early days, like the 80s. And then from the 90s on, Shelley's broken every big story about Whitey since. So we wanted to do this book, and we also felt, for all the books that were out there about Whitey, he was sort of this one-dimensional caricature, almost like just a symptom of his pathology. For lack of a better term, we wanted to humanize him. We wanted to make him not... You hear people call him a monster. Well, you know, that to me is when you reduce somebody just to a pathology, that you don't understand them. So we really wanted to put some skin on these mythical bones and fill out the profile of him. Who is this guy? Why is he like the way he is? And I think the critical difference in our book is that Shelley was able to get access to a remarkable series of letters that Whitey has written in jail since his arrest in June of 2011. These letters, when you read them, it's everybody has opinion about Whitey Bulger, what they think of Whitey Bulger. Mm. This is the first time you actually get to see what he thinks of himself. And for all his problems, lack of self-esteem is not one of them. The guy thinks very highly of himself. And one of the things we have in the book, him talking about, he can't wait to go to trial because he wants to refute the narrative that's out there that he's a killer, an informant, a guy that would kill women, because that doesn't fit with the narrative he spent 80-odd years cultivating. And I think we did it. I think these letters actually get inside his head, and he talks about things. He admits to some crimes, and he denies others.
But he says that I was not an FBI informant. We think that, to him, reputation is everything.
Everything,
and he cannot bear the thought.
Does he say, I'm not a murderer? And,
he doesn't quite say that.
He says he didn't kill the women. I think that there's a certain acceptance that if you're in that gangster life, it's gangsters killing gangsters. There's sort of less sympathy, you know, maybe publicly. But killing women is a whole different story, and he's... Those are the two things he most wants to refute. He says he was not an FBI informant in that he did not kill the women.
There's a lot of grandiosity in the letters that Shelley and I went over, and one of the things is he portrays himself in literary terms. He considers himself, he goes, I feel like Philip Nolan. Philip Nolan was the protagonist of the Edward Everett Hale short story, Man Without a Country. And Whitey would compare himself to Philip Nolan, saying that he feels like a man without a country, that he's been cast adrift. But I would say that Whitey's far more like Gippo Nolan, who was the protagonist of the great story by Liam O'Flaherty, The Informer, because that's what Whitey was. He was an informer.
The interest from even from Hollywood with respect, to Whitey Bulger, and I think put your finger on it there, where you say you never, in your own research and in this book, at no point either of you paint this guy as anything other than what he was. And what he was a very clever, obviously, again, cold-hearted with some Southie principles, which very narrow, but again, like I say, if at this stage of the game what Whitey Bulger is concerned about as how he is perceived and how, you know, he's got a nose, goose is cooked. But he didn't kill women, and he's not an informant. He'd nearly be happy.
Well, as we say in the book, he's not. This is not about getting acquitted. This is about getting even. But the other thing we have that I think is interesting is I think he's a guy of contradictions because he's, as a young man... Or as a kid, he always ran away from the house. He didn't want to be in that house. He didn't want to be part of that family. And yet, when he became a criminal, he had these very old school, traditional values in his mind. He very soon became, you know, romantically involved with a woman named Teresa Stanley, who was a single mom with four kids. And Whitey would insist that the family sit down and have a sit-down dinner every night, in which he would sit there sort of like father knows best, and he'd tell these kids, I don't want you smoking, I don't want you drinking, I want you to study hard, I want you to stay away from bad influences. And then he would get up from that table, Adrian. He would go out and threaten people with guns and knives and extort money. And then he would retire, not to that family, but to a second household where his mistress, Catherine Gregg, awaited for him.
Get a good deal going.
Yeah, great deal going. I don't know how he got all this in. He's a very busy man.
Shelley Murphy, winner, George Polk Award. And well, between you, you have received enough awards without the amazing success. And I think that this that your book, considering that there is still an awful lot of interest.
Yeah.
There is still a trial to be at. Will this trial, will Whitey get what he wants out of this trial, or is this going to be like an open and shut?
I think he will get what he wants out of it. He calls it in letters, he calls it the big show or the big circus. And,
right.
You know, he wants to get out there and put his story forward. I mean, I think Whitey has such a belief in himself that he thinks he can convince us that, you know, that the facts are staring us
right.
in the face.
Well, his friend's saying that if he wanted you to like him,
yeah.
then he would make sure you liked him. And when he was on the run, you know, we now know that he lived in Santa Monica, California
right.
for 15 years in the same rent-controlled apartment. And, you know, he made friends there with people in the building who continue to write to him in jail. And they say, well, you know, I know him as Charlie, and he was always nice to us. And they choose to see, you know, the man who lived up there as this sort of grandfatherly figure. And, you know, even though there were 30 guns hidden in the walls, you know, when they caught him,
yeah.
they, well, you know.
How did he live? How did he, how does he manage to live? I know he lived modestly and whatever, but where did the money come from?
It was all the years of extorting people.
Right.
And he had hidden money, you know, around the world. You know that seized money
from
a safe deposit box in Dublin.
Yeah.
And he had money stashed in London and in Montreal. But he made a lot of money. And he had...
Some of his friends from the crime unit who knew where he was? Did he isolate himself from...
He hid in open view, basically. But like as we show in the book, the first 2 years of the search was sort of a farce because it was assigned, the search was assigned to the very same FBI unit, the Organized Crime Squad, that he had corrupted. The idea that these guys wanted, the last person on earth they wanted to find was Whitey Bulger. But then the search, by that time, when honest cops got involved in the search, I think the trail had gone cold so bad that it took them a long time to find him, and they got lucky. But the other thing you'll see, we found that Whitey really was almost like a semi-recluse. He didn't go out that much. He was conscious that everything is odds. So he would go out in the morning, and then Kathy and him would go out usually at dusk. And, you know, there were all these stories that, after he was arrested, people said, oh, I saw him at Sonny McLean's, the sports bar, the Boston sports bar there, and said, he wouldn't go near that place. Just as I laughed when all those stories saying that he was hiding out in Ireland. The last place he would have gone to Ireland was, first of all, the provost would have put him in a chair and asked him, now that we know you're an informer, we need to ask you some questions, pal. But the other thing, he knew that in an American... in Ireland would have stuck out like a sore thumb, and the Irish would have been talking about him before the sun went down.
Sure, yeah. America's most wanted gangster and the manhunt that brought him to justice. Whitey Bulger by Kevin Cullen and Shelley Murphy. You're listening to Irish Radio Network USA. Thanks to both of you for being here.
It's great to see you again.
Thank you very much.
God bless.